GBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. As President Trump begins his four-day international trip in Scotland, ABC's Rachel Scott says a U.S. controversy remains in the spotlight.
Hanging all over all of this is that ongoing controversy surrounding convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, especially as many of the president's supporters continue to call for more transparency. The White House and the president eager to turn the page very quickly with this trip here in Scotland, hoping to focus on just about anything else.
President Trump, before leaving the White House, did not rule out a pardon for Ghislaine Maxwell, who's serving 20 years for trafficking teenage girls for sex. She was a longtime Epstein companion. She spoke for a second day Friday with the Justice Department's number two, Todd Blanche, who was the president's personal lawyer. Palestinian authorities say at least 25 people were killed by Israeli airstrikes and gunshots. Many of them were awaiting humanitarian aid. This is ABC News. Former Congressman George Santos is now in federal custody, says ABC's Olivia Rubin.
Former Congressman George Santos begins serving out a seven-year sentence. He pled guilty last year to wire fraud and aggravated identity theft. Santos in court admitting to defrauding donors, charging their credit cards without authorization, as well as other crimes. Santos saying a goodbye on social media this week, saying, quote, to those I've disappointed, to those I've let down, to those that I've caused irreparable damage even, I'm sorry.
Beer and food vendors are on strike at historic Fenway Park, the home of baseball's Boston Red Sox. The team said concessions for Friday night's home games performed at the expected levels for a sold-out crowd. The union is asking fans not to buy concessions during games. They want better wages, guardrails on technology, and respect. Aramark says the company has bargained in good faith. Aramark runs the concessions. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Matt Nair on air.
Corrine Hendrickson, you mentioned a conversation with Ron Johnson, Corrine, about the need for child care in Wisconsin. How did that go?
I said, why don't you think we should fund? And he goes, I think an elegant solution, it would be for moms like you to stay home so the other moms can go to work. And I said, well, and I shouldn't get paid for that? And he just kind of stared at us. And I said, that tells me all I need to know.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba,
the founder of Wonderfully Wisconsin. He's been on the show before, but tonight he's here to make the popcorn pick of the week. Mr. Paul Vandenplas,
the Peanut Butter Falcon.
Oh my God, I love when people pick a movie I know nothing about.
A campy comedy buddy story, really just a heartwarming message.
Paul picked a movie that I've never heard of that gets excellent critic and audience reviews. Very well done, Mr. Wonderfully Wisconsin.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shali Pittman. Women of color are far less likely to get media coverage when they go missing. At the state capitol on Friday, Representative Sheila Stubbs of Madison renewed her push for a statewide task force on missing and murdered Black women and girls. It's her third attempt to get it funded.
How much more longer must we wait before the state that we live in decides to do something with the worst disparity in the nation? Once again, this task force will be created by 17 members. This task force has multiple purposes because there's so much that is happening in the state of Wisconsin that have led us to these disparities.
The bill would fund a position in the State Department of Justice to coordinate the task force with a report of proposed solutions due by the end of 2026. It carries a price tag of about $80,000 next year. Sheena Scarborough, whose daughter Sade Robinson was murdered in Milwaukee last year, said the task force could help other families find justice.
As you all know, we just came out of a very high-profile, traumatic, brutal trial you can ever imagine that was live streamed, and everybody in the entire world is watching everything as me and my family are watching it for the first time. We are dealing with ongoing trauma daily.
Attorney General Josh Call also voiced support, calling the effort affordable and necessary. A similar task force for missing and murdered Indigenous women is funded with federal dollars. Advocates say Wisconsin must invest in protecting Black women too, something other states like Minnesota have already begun. For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny and highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, mostly clear, upper 60s. Sunny, hot, and humid for Sunday. Highs in the low 90s. The heat index will push near 100. Sunday night, chance of showers and thunderstorms in low 70s.
Right now, it's 68.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the Wisconsin News headlines for the weekend. Who may be in the running for governor next? And previewing our Tuesday show with Joe Thomas. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4. From Hobart to Bay Settlement, 97.9 WGBW. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host on this broadcast from the stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Delighted and honored that you have chosen to spend some portion of this weekend in discussion, in conversation, in review with me of the mission, the purpose of our broadcast, which is, as always, the examination, the reporting, the analysis of the major stories in the areas of rule of law and justice and government. No exception to that ambitious but achievable agenda this weekend. That includes, as always, your engagement with me and with my producer, Max, in our discussion of those various issues on our syllabus this weekend. You can be a part of our discussion. Send a question, pose an inquiry, make a comment to me and to Max about the subjects on our syllabus. You can call in at 855-752-4842. That number once again is 855-752-4842. Max always reminds me as well that you can be a part of our discussion, a part of our broadcast by sending Max and me a note, a question, an inquiry, whatever is on your mind in the Civic Media Dropbox. Be a part of our discussion this weekend, as always. Our agenda this weekend, as in the past, focuses upon those major rule of law issues that have been percolating up for days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months, and that indeed animates all of the topics that are on our agenda this weekend. Let me tell you a bit about where we're going in this hour of our broadcast and then also in the second hour of our broadcast. Again, always inviting your participation in our discussion. We're going to begin. We're going to begin by talking about the environment and climate change and two significant things that happened just this past week, one overseas and one right here in the United States of America. We're going to talk about something that the World Court did. They're located at The Hague. We're going to talk about a unanimous decision by the World Court commenting upon the obligation of responsible nations across the planet to address and respond reasonably, rationally, and effectively to the great challenge that climate change presents to all of us in this early portion of the 21st century. We'll talk about the extraordinary language used by the World Court in imposing obligations upon the spirit, the focus, the industry of governments throughout the world to address this issue. We'll talk about the connection between the World Court's order and what they described as human rights, civil rights, the basic dignity of all people to live on the planet with certainty about the future and certainty about their present status in a time of great climate change. And then coming back to the United States at the other extreme of that issue, we'll talk about what the Environmental Protection Protection Agency, appears to be underway what they're doing right now, and that is revising dramatically their greenhouse gas emission policy. We'll talk about how that's been in place for a long period of time, the expertise that produced that, and what is probably going to be happening with respect to the rescission, the removal, the withdrawal of some major, not just the language of the policies inside the EPA, but also rescission of policies that would have promoted a greater production of electric vehicles in the future. Tail gas emissions. We'll talk about those two cases in the area of the environment. We necessarily then stay in the United States to talk about, as we always do, the important decisions of federal district court judges. We've got at least two, if not three of them, just this past week. Very interestingly, fascinatingly, on the docket, not only of our discussion, but that of the United States population generally. Yes, two of them focusing again on Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland man improperly, administratively, and erroneously deported, as the government has said, to El Salvador, that high security, brutal prison there, returned just last month upon a return of an indictment against him in the Middle District of Tennessee, where he remains to this day, facing charges by a grand jury there in Middle Tennessee. We will talk about what happened this past week from the pen of a district court judge who's presiding over that criminal case in Middle Tennessee, and then also virtually simultaneously within 90 minutes or so an order that that judge issued with respect to the release, the custodial status of Abrego Garcia, in the custody, not in the custody, in the custody of the government. And the decision then made almost within minutes after that by another judge, and we've talked a lot about her. She's in Maryland. She is presiding over the much related but separate and discreet case. It's a civil case addressing Mr. Abrego Garcia's actual deportation, his immigration status there. She's been working on this case ever since it was filed shortly after his, again, according to the government, erroneous deportation to El Salvador. Fascinating sequence of events and fascinating sequence of orders issued by judges that are going to affect the status of Mr. Abrego Garcia. Is he in prison? Is he detained pretrial? Is he going to be released? What are the circumstances of that? And what are the conditions under which that may happen? Will, as the Attorney General has promised to us, as she has said brazenly, outrageously, that if somehow Mr. Abrego Garcia is released from custody upon a judicial order while that criminal case is pending, she will direct, and the folks from Homeland Security will direct, that he be reapprehended and deported again out of this country to another nation. She has promised that. And we'll talk about the consequences of all of those actions. Yes, Mr. Kilmer Abrego Garcia's case, very much back in the news, affecting the rule of law in America, not just for him. That, of course, is at the top of the list, but also for all of us who are concerned about due process, the role of federal district court judges, and the responses of this government and this attorney general and this Department of Justice to directives from federal judges, both at the trial court level and also the appellate court level. We'll talk about all of that. We will necessarily then talk, as we always seem to talk, about the United States Supreme Court. We have plainly spent a lot of time on this broadcast in broadcast past talking about many, not all, of those 67 major decisions that the Supreme Court issued in a variety of different areas just this past term. The term continues to this day. Those major so-called merits cases, that is the cases that have been properly appealed, they've been discussed, they've been briefed, they've been the subject for oral argument and review. A process has gone forward to produce those opinions, which we've spent a lot of time talking about, including, yes, indeed, that case involving nationwide injunctions, that case involving religious claims by parents to prevent their students from hearing about various stories and storybooks in Maryland, a variety of other things having to do with the Affordable Care Act, having to do with guns in America and ghost guns and Mexico's attempt to try to hold gun manufacturers liable. A great variety of things before the Supreme Court on their merits docket. And yet, even in the wake of their issuing those major cases pretty much concluded at the end of June, they continue to work, prompting an awful lot of people to ask you, me, others. I thought the Supreme Court now was going on vacation for a while, and they plainly are not. They do not go away during the summer, and they typically do issue from time to time decisions about the cases that they will take up in the next term, and they're doing that. And they also still continue historically and certainly in this term, as in the prior term of Donald Trump, they continue to issue these emergency docket orders. This is the so-called shadow docket, about which we've complained an awful lot on this broadcast. By my count, about 20 of them just in the last 6 months or so. We'll give you some more statistics about the significance of the change in the number of emergency orders issued by the Supreme Court. Between the time of the 16 years of the time of the Bush administration, the Obama administration, about 8 of them altogether, 4 of them granted, we have now had 20 of these applications just in the first 6 months of this term of the Trump administration alone. And we will talk about what that means, again, the consequences of that, why that's important. And yes, the focus once again, just this past week, two very significant emergency orders entered by your Supreme Court. Same kind of process. No review, no oral argument on this. Yes, there's some briefing done, some petitions made. Issuing orders, that is the Supreme Court issuing orders without that process going ahead. One sentence, two sentence orders resolving the applications for emergency appeal. One of these from the government. Another one of them, interestingly, very interestingly, coming from some Native American Indian tribes in the Eighth Circuit, asking that a major case, which will percolate up again in the coming term involving the Voting Rights Act, asking that the United States Supreme Court intervene and stop the application of an Eighth Circuit decision with respect to the applicability, the use, the invocation of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In both of these cases, both emergency appeals in very different kinds of situations, in both of them, the Supreme Court granting the applications, one's for the government related to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. We'll talk about that. The other one related to the Voting Rights Act in the Eighth Circuit. Completely different issues, completely different focuses down the road. And both of them important not only in their own right. We'll talk about the significance of these decisions coming out of the Supreme Court now and in the future as well. And we're also going to chat about another thing that happened just late this past week, having to do with sanctuary cities and a judge making a major determination about a lawsuit brought by the administration. This is the reverse. This is the Trump administration filing a lawsuit against a municipality just to the south of us here in Wisconsin, in Chicago, alleging that the conduct of municipal authorities in Illinois, in Chicago, undermine the safety and security of our nation. We'll talk about that. We'll tell you what a federal district court judge there did just this past week in shutting down that lawsuit by the federal government. And then in our second hour, after all of that, and that is a lot, we are then going to turn necessarily back once again to the Jeffrey Epstein matter. And we'll take your phone calls about all of that, the Jeffrey Epstein matters, in our second hour. But in the first hour, all of these things related to the rule of law and government, due process and justice in America. Stay with us for all of that and more.
97.9 WGBW and WGBW.FM.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We reported last fall that Maine voters approved ballot question 1, limiting contributions to super PACs spending money in state elections. It passed with massive voter support, but like the state's foreign influence ban, was ruled as likely unconstitutional. That's what organizers hoped would happen. The ballot question reads, do you want to set a $5,000 limit for giving to political action committees that spend money independently to support or defeat candidates for office? The act also required super PAC donors to be disclosed. A First Circuit Federal District Court ruled July 15th that both provisions violated free speech protections and pointed to the Citizens United, Buckley v. Valeo, and other past U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig argues that large contributions to PACs risk quid pro quo corruption of supported candidates, even if a candidate isn't directly speaking with the super PAC. Elon Musk's America PAC and crypto industry super PAC support of Donald Trump are recent examples. Lessig said in 2023, when the initiative was announced, that it was designed to force the U.S. Supreme Court to answer whether contributions to super PACs can be regulated by states in the same way state candidate contributions are limited. The case will next be appealed in the First Circuit, then could reach the U.S. Supreme Court in late 2026. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Skilled trade workers are the backbone of every community, and also the Army National Guard. Soldiers train to keep the power flowing, engines running, and in every other trade needed to accomplish the mission. These soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Is getting vaccinated on your to-do list? We can help you check that off.
You've got this.
Yes, you do. See how we've got you at yougotthis.usaging.org. A message from the Aging and Disability Vaccination Collaborative, powered by U.S. Aging.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
My name is Jim Santel. I am your host on Amicus Law Review this hour and next hour as well. Again, so very pleased that you are spending some time with Max, my producer, and me this weekend talking about these major issues in the area of law and government and the aspiration for justice in our nation and around the planet. And that is where we begin another programming note. And that is we are, yes, going to be addressing what seems to have occupied this imbroglio called the Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell matter in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about that in our second hour this morning, going to give you some perspectives of what we know and what we don't know, what the truth is and what we are speculating about. And by me, we, I do not mean you and me. I mean the folks in Washington, D.C. who have turned this into a parlor game. We'll talk about a thing called Occam's Razor. Occam's Razor, which many of you know well, this notion that the simplest explanation about things in life is almost always the right one. We'll talk about why that is so applicable in this situation and all the conspiracies within conspiracies that unfortunately are animating this thing in Washington, diverting attention from more important issues like education and healthcare and agriculture and labor and commerce and international relations and, yes, indeed, environmental issues. Why all of that needs to be put in context and also some commentary about our United States Department of Justice. But before we get to that, let us talk about the environment. Perhaps as many people, including now a major tribunal, have referred to it as an existential threat. Let's talk first about what happened overseas just this past week in something called the International Court of Justice. It is the United Nations highest court. And although the United States follows what the UN Court, the International Court of Justice, says and does, sometimes called the World Court, The reality is we do not subject ourselves to the jurisdiction of it, have not done that under administrations present and past, but watch it carefully and thoughtfully and regard it as a legitimate court, even though not exercising jurisdiction over us and our government here in the United States of America. Even so, it is a significant thing that just this past week, for the first time in its history, at the request of the United Nations itself, of which we are a part, as you know well, the UN court weighing in on the what it called the urgent and existential threat of climate change, describing it as this major, major issue that implicates the actions, the conduct of governments and peoples throughout the world. It was the first time that the court, again, United Nations' highest judicial body, has weighed in on climate change. A unanimous opinion from the members of the Court of Justice saying that the failure of nations across the planet to take action to protect the climate system on our planet can constitute, this is their language, an internationally wrongful act, coming in awfully close to talking about criminality, an internationally wrongful act. The court also finding that protection of the environment, in their words, a precondition for ensuring what? For ensuring human rights. And they cited government support of fossil fuel production as a potential violation of those principles. It is an internationally wrongful act to fail to protect our climate, and it's a precondition to human rights, to basic fundamental human dignity across the planet. Every nation, I would offer, including ours as well, even though we are not subject to the jurisdiction of the UN court, it is a precondition to human rights, fundamental dignity, fundamental notions about the way that we live and quite literally breathe in America. Judge Yuji, who's the president of the court, said this. He said, the environment is the foundation for human life upon which the health and well-being of both present and future generations depend. Now, significantly, I know what you're asking, the International Court of Justice. Yes, no mechanism to enforce this opinion. It is therefore advisory. It's not binding. It's not compelling on nations. But it's an important statement about legal principles on the findings that the court makes, could have and should have, right? Should have far-reaching influence on litigation in the courts around the world, including our courts right here, should have an impact upon international negotiations, the Paris Accords, the treaties, those kinds of things, on climate policy and funding. The United Nations General Assembly, of which we are a part, we're also part of the Security Council, of course, among the major leaders of the UN, requested this opinion after what can only be described as a very animated, a spirited, years-long campaign organized by law students from around the world. It led to a two-week hearing in December. And at that time, about 100 countries and various organizations and experts addressed the court, hoping to influence the opinion. And so we get, from the 15 judges, answers to the questions that was posed to them, including what countries are obliged to do under the existing international laws and treaties to protect our system, to protect our climate, the environment for the future, in particular, greenhouse gases. Keep that in mind. We'll get back to that. And what the legal consequences are, if any, by the acts, the omissions, as lawyers and judges like to describe them, if in fact they cause significant harm and failure and fail to do anything. The powerful fossil fuel producers, including the United States and Saudi Arabia, argued before the court that the 2015 Paris Accord, in which nearly all countries agreed to limit greenhouse gases, was sufficient to address climate change. And so, arguing no further statements are necessary, plainly, that was not adopted by the court's 15 judges. And we have instead this statement by them, calling global warming an urgent and existential threat. At this decision, this ruling, these proceedings in The Hague, closely watched around the world, and should be closely watched by every American every citizen concerned about the future of our nation, the future of the globe. We are all partners in this. When we come back, we'll do the juxtaposition at the other extreme on what our EPA, our Environmental Protection Agency, did, appears to be doing right now, completely contrary to what the Hague Court said just this past week. We'll do that as Amicus, a law review, continues on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. As President Trump begins his four-day international trip in Scotland, ABC's Rachel Scott says a U.S. controversy remains in the spotlight.
Hanging all over all of this is that ongoing controversy surrounding convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, especially as many of the president's supporters continue to call for more transparency. The White House and the president eager to turn the page very quickly with this trip here in Scotland, hoping to focus on just about anything else.
President Trump, before leaving the White House, did not rule out a pardon for Ghislaine Maxwell, who's serving 20 years for trafficking teenage girls for sex. She was a longtime Epstein companion. She spoke for a second day Friday with the Justice Department's number two, Todd Blanche, who was the president's personal lawyer. Palestinian authorities say at least 25 people were killed by Israeli airstrikes and gunshots. Many of them were awaiting humanitarian aid. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Brewers baseball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers host the Miami Marlins. Lefty Jose Quintana on the mound for Milwaukee against Miami right-hander Jansen Junk. The Crew losing last night 5-1. Pitcher Freddy Peralta said there was a real cat-and-mouse game going on between him and the Marlins batters.
I was able to speed them up a little bit because they were trying to slow me down, and I was just trying to get them quick on the box and try to make my pitch and make them out quick because they knew what they with it. But we realized that we had no time, and we made the adjustment.
NFL in Green Bay, Mark Murphy saying goodbye after 17 years as the Packers president and CEO. Murphy holding a final press conference after the shareholders meeting that drew over 6,000 shareholders. Murphy's advice to his successor, Ed Policy.
Fire quickly, hire slowly. So take your time, you know, when you're hiring people.
That's Mark Murphy with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
As Wisconsin has a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny and highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, mostly clear, upper 60s. Sunny, hot, and humid for Sunday. Highs in the low 90s. The heat index will push near 100. Sunday night, chance of showers and thunderstorms in low 70s.
Right now, it's 70.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
All of these things should sound off alarm bells bigly. You see what Donald Trump's doing with Harvard and with Columbia. You see what he's doing with Paramount. ABC capitulated in a lawsuit to Trump. We're America. We're not Hungary. We're a democracy. We're always going to be a democracy. Yeah, that's what they thought in Hungary. The way that Viktor Orban and the right wing gained power was by using a little bit of power to get more power, to use pressure on networks.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Matt and Air on Air.
Kareen Hendrickson, you mentioned a conversation with Ron Johnson, Kareen, about the need for child care in Wisconsin. How did that go?
I said, why don't you think we should fund? And he goes, I think an elegant solution, it would be for moms like you to stay home so the other moms can go to work. And I said, well, and I shouldn't get paid for that? And he just kind of stared at us. And I said, that tells me all I need to know.
Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Every 15 seconds, someone is diagnosed with cancer. If it's happened to you or someone you love, the American Cancer Society can help at every step of the journey. Visit cancer.org today.
Jay Matt Nair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Civic Media News Director Shally Pittman will be joining us to break down all of the news that happened over the weekend. Nothing will happen. Join us.
Matt Nair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, encouraging you to be part of our broadcast. Call me, call Max at 855-752-4842. Be a part of our online studio chat. Send me especially your questions. There are a lot of things to discuss, a lot of things that are head scratchers to all of us. Be a part of our discussion here on Amicus, a law review. Our discussion this weekend, beginning in this first hour of our broadcast, talking about the environment, the subject of a lot of litigation in America, at the Supreme Court, at appeals courts, at district courts, state courts, federal courts. It is a significant issue. It is, as the World Court has said, an urgent and existential matter that needs to be addressed. And while the World Court tells nations and their leaders around the face of the planet what it is they're obliged to do, talks about their failure to act as being internationally wrongful and obliges them to do something as a precondition to human rights. That's the way they spoke about the significance of this case. Even while that is happening this past week at The Hague, overseas, our own government, our own Environmental Protection Agency, plainly appears to be heading in the opposite direction. Perhaps not surprisingly, given this administration's lack of focus, lack of commitment, lack of belief in the fundamental thing that scientists tell us, and that's where we begin. The Environmental Protection Agency, as you know, created by a former president, his name Richard Nixon. He was concerned about the future of the planet and the nation and communities locally as well, the way in which we live and breathe. Breathe and drink water and abide in each other's company. Just this past week, we learned that the Trump administration, inside the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, charged with issuing rules and regulations, enforcing the laws of our Congress, enforcing the rules established legitimately, lawfully by the EPA to enact, to execute on what the Congress tells it to do. Trump administration is drafting a plan to repeal, to rescind, to pull back on a fundamental, a core scientific finding that has animated our policy in this country for years. That policy has given the United States government authority to do what? To regulate greenhouse gas emissions and fight climate change. The proposed Environmental Protection Agency rule that's coming up, apparently in process, would rescind, pull back, eliminate a 2009 declaration. What is that all about? It's known as the endangerment finding. Endangerment finding sounds very ominous, and indeed it is. The endangerment finding, a scientifically established concept created by, authored by, the product of people who know what they're talking about, establishing that greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane do in fact endanger human lives. That's what scientists tell us as a part of the scientific method as they work through these issues. That is not just the latest view. That is the current status of the scientific understanding about the reason why we have climate change. That finding, that core finding, that endangerment finding, the foundation, the core, the basis for what? It's the basis for the EPA's only tool, the exclusive tool that it has to limit the climate pollution from vehicles, power plants, and other industries that collectively are dangerously heating our planet. That's the basis upon which our government can issue rules and regulations with respect to vehicles and power plants and other industries out there that are producing these gases that change our lives. The EPA proposal which is probably going to be made public in the next several days, calls for rescinding those limits on what? Tailpipe emissions. Those tailpipe emissions standards, restrictions, were designed to encourage automakers, we know who they are out there, to build and sell more electric vehicles as one of the important ways of addressing climate pollution, greenhouse gas pollution in America. The regulations, again, the basis of the endangerment finding, derived from the endangerment finding, a fundamental part of administration's past to move the country away from these gasoline-powered vehicles that, again, a majority of us drive. Transportation sector, of course, is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States of America. The EPA apparently intends to argue that imposing climate regulations on automakers poses the real harm, the real actual harm to human health, because it will lead to higher prices and reduced consumer choice. And that apparently is what's animating this apparent rescission of this major doctrine, this set of rules, removing this endangerment finding that, again, gives the EPA, our government, the capacity to impose rules that promise or at least anticipate a cleaner future. Going in the opposite direction here in America from what the UN Court, the Court at The Hague, the International Court of Justice is telling us that we must do, and describing, therefore, what the EPA is doing as an internationally wrongful act, appreciating, of course, that what we do here in the United States does not just affect us here in the 50 states and territories of our country, but affects people worldwide. Wild divergence this past week. Rule of law issues, climate issues, government issues in the area of the environment. Plainly, more controversy, more action and government inaction as that issue moves forward. Let's change our focus a bit to federal district court judges in the United States of America. We have talked about them a lot in the context of these many executive orders that the president has issued in the past 6 months. Well in excess now of 100 of those, most of them being the subject of attacks in the federal district courts. And we have chatted about a lot of those. Most of the federal judges taking those up have been finding variously that the executive orders are unconstitutional, that they cannot stand, subject to appeal, subject to the Supreme Court review, which we will also get to. But we've also been talking about the work of federal district court judges and appellate court judges, and yes, indeed, the Supreme Court when it comes to this deportation issue, the immigration issue, the deportations of people, some of whom are subject indeed to deportation. The questions are due process afforded to them. Some of them not afforded, many of them not afforded due process in terms of their arrests, their deportations, their movements without due process to other nations. And that has included a man named Kilmer Abrego Garcia. You know his name well. He is probably the one among the hundreds of deportees in this category of immigration focus. He is the one whose name you know best. Who is he? Well, you know that in March of this past year, he was detained. He was deported to this brutal high security prison in El Salvador, along with about 200 and almost 248 others. Absent due process protections mandated by Congress and mandated also by the judges, at least one of them, her name is Paula Zinnes, arguably two or three others, who are saying you need to afford these people due process before you arrest them, detain them. And it may well be at the end of that process that they are not only deportable, but should be deported. And so we're not quabbling with you about the decision ultimately to remove them from our nation, but requiring that you do this according to a due process regime. Abrego Garcia remained in that prison, as you know, with great controversy for many weeks. And during that time period, the government said that we cannot return him. He is there, even though the government early on said this was an administrative error. He should not have been deported, a subject brought to the attention of the federal district court, Judge Zinnes. And she demanding, therefore, that he be brought back to this country. Doesn't happen until our attorney general announces in June, just last month, that lo and behold, a federal grand jury in the Middle District of Tennessee has returned a federal grand jury indictment, charging men two counts with the illegal, unlawful transportation of undocumented people, illegal aliens, as the grand jury indictment says. Other allegations nestled into that narrative account, which we've talked about. And based upon that, Abrego Garcia is brought back to the United States of America from that prison in El Salvador, and he has remained in custody in the Middle District of Tennessee to this time, to this day, awaiting trial on those counts. He's no longer overseas. He's no longer in that high-security, brutal prison in El Salvador. He is now in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons in the Middle District of Tennessee awaiting trial. And while awaiting trial, he has been subject to questions about whether or not he should be released pending trial. We've talked about this a lot in other contexts. You know the standards well because it now trips off your tongue. Those standards, whether or not the defendant is a risk of flight, whether he or she will leave, and whether that person is a risk to the community, risk to the safety and security of all of us. Those are the two standards. And at least up until now, the courts there, including a magistrate judge, have kept him in custody along the way very significantly. Our attorney general, my attorney general, her name Pam Bondi, has said notoriously, wildly, that if indeed a judge should release Abrego Garcia while he's awaiting trial, which is routinely done, not always, but can be done, nothing wrong with that. If that happens, she said, I promise you that I'll send the federal law enforcement authorities to pick him up again and deport him a second time, even while he's waiting trial on this grand jury indictment in Middle Tennessee. That, I would offer to you, is outrageous, and it is important because it animates what happens this past week. We've got two judges. I'll introduce one of them to you. I suspect you have not heard his name before, but you'll hear a whole lot more about him. His name is Waverly Crenshaw, C-R-E-N-S-H-A-W. He is in the Middle District of Tennessee. He is the judge, the federal district court judge there, who has been assigned responsibility for presiding over the criminal case, that indictment against Abrego Garcia. He is doing pretrial matters, motions and hearings, all those kinds of things that attend any trial, any federal trial, any state trial as well. When it comes to the pretrial proceedings, he is responsible for those, and he will oversee the trial itself of Abrego Garcia on those counts in the grand jury indictment returned by the grand jury. Now, he also has jurisdiction, of course, over the defendant, over the body that is before him. That's Mr. Abrego Garcia. And he has looked at all of this, and he has said a number of very interesting things just this past week. He said, first of all, as I look at the evidence, and yes, indeed, it's not a trial, but as I look, he said, at the evidence that the government has presented, at least initially, in support of its statement about the future of this trial, what it's going to present, but also, significantly, the reasons why Mr. Abrego Garcia is a danger to the community. He said, when the government has presented that preliminary, again, not final, not exhaustive, presentation of its evidence, he calls it a poor attempt by the government to tie Mr. Abrego Garcia to all the bad things that are alleged in that indictment about him. Talks about it being insufficient from his perspective. He's not the jury, but from his perspective early on, throwing cold water on the notion that this indictment somehow incorporates and conveys compelling, not even close to beyond a reasonable doubt type of evidence. And beyond that, he says this: when I look at Mr. Abrego Garcia from Maryland, his family is still there. He has been here legally, administratively, in error deported. He says, I don't see a reason to do that. I don't see a reason to keep him in custody. So he orders that he be released. He is not a risk of flight, Judge Crenshaw finds, and he is also not a danger to the community. And almost immediately after that, Judge Paula Zinnes in Maryland issues another order related to that order of Judge Crenshaw about 90 minutes. When we come back, I'll tell you what Paula Zinnes does in another district in Maryland with respect to the status of Abrego Garcia. It is a fascinating legal, jurisprudential, rule of law issue percolating up this week. We're talking all about it here on Amicus, a law review.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
Hey, it's Amanda, and we all know that Northeast Wisconsin has some of the best events around, but trying to find them all can be tricky. So here at WGBW, we decided to do the work for you. Prevent boredom on any night by going to WGBW.fm and click events in the top right corner. You'll never have to spend forever scrolling to find out what's going on in your area. And if you got an event to share, hit us up by emailing info at WGBW.fm. We can work together to have real news and great conversation while giving you the 411 on what's happening in New Wisco.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. After weeks of speculation, Governor Tony Evers has finally made his decision. He is not running for a third term. Evers has had an accomplished career as a dedicated public servant for 5 decades and has been a terrific governor for the state of Wisconsin these last 6+ years, and we should be grateful for his time in office. It's been a job well done. But all things must pass. In making this decision to step aside and not seek another term, Tony Evers is doing what he has done time and time again. He's doing the right thing. And perhaps in making this decision, Governor Evers can be the one to turn the tide on the Democratic Party's unwillingness to pass the torch to the next generation. In his own unassuming way, the mild-mannered former science teacher who became Wisconsin's governor can be an example to Democrats across the nation. Because we know what happens in Wisconsin politics often has ramifications that reach well beyond the state's borders.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We reported last fall that Maine voters approved ballot question 1, limiting contributions to super PACs spending money in state elections. It passed with massive voter support, but like the state's foreign influence ban, was ruled as likely unconstitutional. That's what organizers hoped would happen. The ballot question reads, do you want to set a $5,000 limit for giving to political action committees that spend money independently to support or defeat candidates for office? The act also required super PAC donors to be disclosed. A First Circuit Federal District Court ruled July 15th that both provisions violated free speech protections and pointed to the Citizens United, Buckley v. Valeo, and other past U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig argues that large contributions to PACs risk quid pro quo corruption of supported candidates, even if a candidate isn't directly speaking with the super PAC. Elon Musk's America PAC and crypto industry super PAC's support of Donald Trump are recent examples. Lessig said in 2023, when the initiative was announced, that it was designed to force the U.S. Supreme Court to answer whether contributions to super PACs can be regulated by states in the same way state candidate contributions are limited. The case will next be appealed in the First Circuit, then could reach the U.S. Supreme Court in late 2026. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are in the first hour of our two-hour broadcast this weekend. We are necessarily, importantly, revisiting some significant developments in this immigration deportation indictment case involving Kilmer Abrego Garcia. He is still in custody in the Middle District of Tennessee, awaiting trial on a 2-count indictment coming out of a grand jury there involving the illegal transportation of undocumented persons. Just this past week, the judge who's presiding over that matter, pretrial and ultimately trial, his name, Waverly Crenshaw, issues an order directing that Mr. Abrego Garcia be released, not only because the evidence, at least presented to this point by the government, does not compel a finding that he is a risk to the community, and suggesting the judge does, that even the underlying evidence is a pretty poor attempt to establish criminality here. So Judge Crenshaw says he needs to be released. And of course, this all happens in the midst of these threats by our United States government that if indeed he is released, he will be apprehended once again and deported again, the case against him dismissed, and will deport him again, says my attorney general. Well, that prompts action by another district judge. You know her well. Her name is Paula Zinnes. She has been frustrated, an understatement of wild dimension, with the conduct of attorneys in front of her. She is handling the immigration case, not the criminal case the immigration case pending in front of her challenging Mr. Abrego Garcia's deportation, his status generally. And she, within minutes of Judge Crenshaw's decision to release Mr. Abrego Garcia, she issues another order. And she, in her order, bars federal immigration authorities from immediately taking Mr. Abrego Garcia into custody when he's released from Tennessee. In other words, you can release him, but federal government, you keep your hands off of him. The order restored him to the legal situation that Mr. Abrego Garcia would have been in before he was arrested in Maryland on March 12th and sent to El Salvador a few days after that. In her measure, she tells, again, the federal authorities, don't you dare. Don't you dare pick him up. I'm directing you as a federal judge that you do not have the authority to take him again, arrest him again, deport him again, as the administration has indicated it will do. She's also ordered that the government begin any new removal proceedings against Mr. Abrego Garcia in Maryland. If you want to go down that road, a whole new proceeding has to be initiated. The judge also ordering the administration to provide Abrego Garcia and his lawyers with a warning of at least 3 business days if they intend, if their purpose is indeed to start the process of seeking his expulsion to a country other than El Salvador. Along the way, as she has done before, we're back at it. The judge once again says that the department has acted badly, wildly badly, in its disposition of this case. Her order was issued again about 2 weeks after she excoriated government attorneys in her court at a hearing for having, she said, destroyed the traditional bonds of trust that courts typically afford government lawyers. And that is true. It's not a complete deference, but it's some trust that if indeed government lawyers come before you on a search warrant and representations made in open court on applications for the discovery of evidence, there is an assumption that the government lawyers are true and genuine and that they have integrity. She has said that has been destroyed. She accused the government lawyers of defiance and foot dragging in complying with her initial decision handed down in April to facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody in El Salvador. That recalcitrance, she said, is at the heart of a request made by Abrego Garcia's lawyers to bring sanctions against Trump officials. She rebuked the administration for the way in which it brought Mr. Abrego Garcia back to the United States after having charged him in Nashville. Now, what is the status of all this? 2 court orders effectively releasing him and also saying, don't you dare deport him as you promised to do. It is fascinating in terms of the judicial interaction in these 2 districts, effectively telling the government that if he is released, he is not to be deported. And oh, by the way, if you want to go down that road, you've got to start an entirely new proceeding. That is the joint effect of the orders issued by Judge Waverly Crenshaw and by Judge Paula Zinnes in Middle Tennessee and in Maryland, respectively. Now, why is this important? Well, Mr. Garcia is still in custody right now. And that is because of the concern about what your Department of Justice says about what happens if he's released. And both parties, the government and Mr. Garcia, both have wisely said, until we can ensure that nothing bad happens here, and bad, I mean things that are contrary to the orders of these judges, we need to stay on that release. And so he is still in custody. His lawyers plainly in consultation, we're not privy to those, nor should we be, about how we go effectively implementing these orders. What are we going to do? And the government lawyers, of course, have an interest also. They should have an interest on your behalf and mine in ensuring compliance with what courts say that they need to do. And so while all of this is straightened out, the defendant himself, the former deportee, Mr. Kilmer Abrego Garcia, remains in custody, but he now has in his hand 2 very important orders from federal judges that say upon his release, he can return to Maryland, and upon his return to Maryland, he is not to be redeported. He will have to return at some point to the Middle District of Tennessee to face that trial in front of Judge Crenshaw. And yes, indeed, the immigration proceedings before Judge Zinnes, those have to proceed as well. Neither one of these cases is dismissed, but his custody will no longer be in that of the Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. Marshals Service. All of that happening just this past week. Terrifically interesting and not dispositive, but important issues. Of course, the government itself saying that we're going to respond dramatically to this. An Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security saying that Abrego Garcia will never walk America's streets again, calling outrageous, lawless, and insane the decisions by these judges. She says that their orders plainly are not to be followed. And that, of course, undermining the rule of law in America. When we come back, we'll talk about the United States Supreme Court, another institution of the rule of law, when Amicus, a law review, continues.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Trump's in Scotland, but he's not been able to escape questions about Jeffrey Epstein and Epstein's longtime companion, Ghislaine Maxwell. Maxwell, serving 20 years in prison, met Thursday and Friday with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche.
Sources tell ABC News Maxwell requested the meeting and was granted a limited form of immunity so she could answer questions without fear her responses could later be used against her.
She was asked maybe about 100 different people. She answered questions about everybody. And she didn't hold anything back.
That's ABC's Eric Kotursky speaking with Maxwell's lawyer. The Attorney General Pam Bondi reportedly told the president in May his name was in Epstein's files. He's denied that. It does not indicate any wrongdoing. New humanitarian worries in Gaza, where 25 people were killed, according to Palestinian authorities, many of whom were waiting for aid as the UN warns of starvation. This is ABC News. California.